Maybe we could begin just by going around the table, and you could each explain how you define peace, whether in relationship to the text, or perhaps in relationship to the text in contemporary geopolitical events, perhaps in your own lives. In a way, what does perpetual peace mean to you? Not just what does peace mean to you, but what does perpetual peace suggest?
Both perpetual and both peace. And I would like to add that we already had a workshop in this morning. And just to give you an example of the amazing things that we heard there, one fellow student of yours said she was from Tunisia, which is where we yesterday mentioned Egypt and the current events there, which is, of course, where this revolutionary process in the Middle East now started. And she felt that Tunisia and her own experience in her own country made her reflect on the notion of peace, and in a very scary way, as it had been portrayed by the regime that has now been toppled. So please also tell us a bit if you think and reflect on the notion of peace and the notion of perpetual peace, and how Kant presents it. Tell us also about yourself, maybe, if you want to. Tell us also your name and who you are and what made you interested in this subject. Okay, maybe we start with you.
Okay. My name is Aaron Maddow. I'm from Lansdale, Pennsylvania. I'm studying Haverford, obviously. I guess for me, the word perpetual means everlasting, and it's kind of self-sustaining in a way. There's a set of conditions, and it continues to progress forward from there and to maintain itself. When I think of peace, I think in some ways I think it has to do with the idea of security, but in the same way that a security that's affirming and that is it's a value among people, and we understand that something that's sacred to human life and human happiness, and something that shouldn't be considered alien to the human condition, but a part of it that's natural and brings out the best of us.
So you say that kind of peace is in a sense part of the human condition.
I think when we get down to what we want humans to be, I think that's a flexible idea. In some ways, I think peace is essential.
It's
part of that.
What we want humans to be. Is it something humans are?
Is it something humans are? I think we're always evolving. I think currently, I don't think it really is something of what we are, because we see around the world there's so many absence of violent conflict and so many reasons for people to fight and strike out against each other. But I think it is something that we can make part of ourselves by internalizing, what does it mean to live in peace is a question we don't really ask. In countries where we have peace, we don't think about it too much. Mm-hmm. In countries where they don't have it, I'm not the best person to speak about that. So.
But it's very fascinating that you brought up that question. It wasn't brought up in the last workshop, the question of human nature. What are we really inclined towards peacefulness? Are we inclined towards peace? Or are we inclined to strive for it? Or is it the opposite? Kant has a few ideas on this, but it's a very fascinating discussion.
What do you think Kant says about human nature?
I think Kant, he obviously talks about the way there's natural mechanisms that are going to progress us towards that idea. I think, which is some ways a cheery idea, but I think it's really up to us. What does Kant say? He seems to say that it's natural and almost preordained in a sense, but that I think we need, that it requires humans having this idea of morality and accepting it and internalizing it and working towards it.
He also says that it's natural for the... when he talks about human nature, he says that human nature is much more inclined to war, I think.
Yeah, it's almost a very Hobbes-like idea.
Yeah.
But then again, he also seems to say, the natural processes of the world, the divine providence, will lead us there. I think if Kant is looking at how nations, if they ought to operate, if they factor in morality, he seems to think then that humans, if we consider morality, and we will be brought to peace. I think that's an optimistic idea. If you make people think about morality in terms of self-interest or what's best for them, as terms of morality being what's best for you, I think we can begin to understand how that can be something that's more intrinsic.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm Rachel Cobesa, and I'm from New Haven, Connecticut. I go to Haverford. I guess I'm interested in peace and adding perpetual before the word peace, because I grew up in a family where going to demonstrations and being peace activists was a really big part of my upbringing. And I was so cushioned in that world, and it felt like this was always the right thing to do. And then When I started going to school, having conversations with people, and how much negativity there can be towards the idea of peace, like, oh, that's too idealistic, and we can never achieve it, and people, like, shoot down this idea of peace as being something, well, you can have really lofty conversations about it, and you can hope that this is something you can achieve, but instead of acting on it as a viable idea, people kind of push it away. And that makes me really, I don't like that at all, because I do think that as if you push it away, then obviously it's not going to be something that we can achieve, because you're already, like, saying, oh no, peace is too idealistic.
And so what does perpetual peace mean?
I don't even think about it in relation, you know, there's that conversation about whether we're constantly in a state of war and peace is the intermissions, or that it's constantly peace with these breaks with war. And I think perpetual peace isn't war doesn't enter the conversation, because it's just perpetual peace is what it is. Like I think I said that it rises above that conversation of war and peace, because perpetual peace just is like the state of, no, I don't even want to say state, it just sort of like is. It's not explaining it very well, but it doesn't have to relate to anything, and it doesn't have to be in comparison to anything, because it's ongoing and like what people accept is,
It would not be dialectical. It wouldn't be peace defined in opposition to war. Perpetual peace would be kind of something outside of that dialectical.
Exactly.
Thing.
Yeah.
Going back to the negativity that you have encountered,
mm-hmm.
Do you think there is a naive and unrealistic way to talk about peace? I mean,
yeah, sure. I think that even you can with anything, you can be naive and idealistic about it to certain extremes, but that's not to discount. Like, even on any level, thinking about it, I think, is important in a positive light. And sometimes if you go maybe too far and people say that could never happen, then you can pull back. But it's not, you're not thinking, you're not, you adjust and you change your perception a little bit.
But people who say it can never happen, they don't necessarily say it should never happen. I mean, peace
right.
can be a goal, or maybe it is a goal that we all share. It is then about how to achieve this goal that,
mm-hmm.
that people might not agree, and some are idealistic and some are, I don't know how to call them, realistic. Or,
and that's also hard, because then it becomes, it's kind of how I think about like this idea of activists, but like you have people who are very have one idea about how things should be done, and then other people who are coming in and saying, no, but let's try this different way. And there's like a tension between the two groups who obviously want the same want the same thing, but the ways of getting there are so different. And instead of like seeing the final thing as being the destination point and that we can work together, people start fighting about how they're getting to the same place,
mm-hmm.
which I've always thought was really silly. So, like,
do you think this tension, that there is a tension between theory and practice? Because Kant talks about that.
I think sometimes, definitely, yeah. I mean, I've felt it. And people who want to, that difference between like talking and doing is often a point of contention, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And would you let, if you look, I mean, I think it's fascinating that you participated in peace demonstrations and that you were or are a peace activist. And if you look at that phenomenon, which is somehow, as far as I understand, peace movements are not, I mean, they seem to me a little bit of something of the past.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's becoming less and less, at least in Europe. How would you characterize the ideas of peace movements and of peace activism, and does it have anything to do with what Kant tries to achieve?
Well, I think like it's peace movements often seem to arise as in opposition to something. So like I am reacting to the Vietnam War happening, and so then there's going to be a greater movement for peace. But it's not like necessarily in our everyday lives there's some greater peace movement, which is interesting. just lost the train of thought.
So you think peace movements are sometimes a reaction towards specific situations of war?
They
and
often
conflict,
be our reactions, which then goes back to that idea of like if peace is always in opposition to something else, because if you can only like garner support for peace when there is a visible war happening, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting thought. Okay.
I'm Evangeline Kujeski, and I like to think of perpetual peace as something that starts with the individual and is, like, within myself, and then it kind of fizzles out to little groups and then bigger groups and then between large groups of people.
So if I want to go back to that first comment that you made, that individuated understanding of peace. What was the process of reading Kant's essay on perpetual peace? Did you find that possibility within Kant's text, or did you not at all find it, given that he's also very much thinking on the level of the nation state, or at least something like the Republican kind of constitutional kind of state? Could you relate to the text in that sense?
I mean, I think that he's focused on the larger level, but I think there's an underlying idea that, like, in order to end hostility, it must be ended on smaller levels too.
Mm-hmm. And what does it mean to be at peace with oneself? You started out with saying that one needs to achieve peace first on an individual level. You meant being at peace with oneself, right?
Is that like, do you mean it as like, is it a state of being or is it just a constant process or negotiation?
Yeah, I definitely think it's not something, a place where I get to and like, oh, I'm at peace. It's definitely a constant, I mean, it's hard. I think it's a hard process where you just keep rethinking and exploring and...
Is this a dimension that is missing in Kant's text? He doesn't really talk that much about the individual.
Yeah, and I do think that might be missing, because I think that's an important aspect of perpetual peace that needs to be talked about and addressed.
So people who are leading wars are not at peace with themselves, or... That would be interesting, almost a psychological approach to war, to look at the people who, the decision makers, the statesmen, the people who are in favor of war, to look at their, if they're at peace with themselves or not, you know. But what would that mean to be at peace with oneself? I mean, in this, I think that we know when we talk, somebody's... not as peace with oneself when we think there's a person that has problems, you know, or is not happy with himself. But we do not necessarily think of society then, or we do not necessarily think of international relations. And I think it's fascinating that you make this connection.
Yeah, and I do think that being at peace with oneself includes being at peace with others.
Mm-hmm. It's a necessary condition.
That's what it was. It caught me off guard when I heard it. But one of the people that was just in the film segment we played, Jean-Marc Coico, the director of the United Nations University, when we filmed him, we spoke with him. He explained that in his work and in his thinking, he approaches international conflict from the perspective that if a country is not internally at peace, it cannot engage in peaceful relations with others. And it was a very psychological kind of reading that I didn't expect to hear from him, but he was fundamentally committed to this kind of reading, this perspective, not only on an individual level, but even on the level of a nation state today, that one would need to be in an internal state of peace, however defined, or at least one would have to aspire to that on some level, some fundamental self-reflexive level, to engage in peaceful relations with others.
How could peace... I mean, if you imagine the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, how should one talk about peace when one thinks of these two countries? How could the discussion be improved in a sense?
Well, I think it needs to be personalized. I think that's an issue, as it seems such like a distant issue. And if we think about peace as something that maybe we cannot have peace within ourselves until we are at peace with others, then it brings us to ourself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's important.
Okay.
Hi. Hi, my name is Lawrence Wang. I think that, like, peace, like, okay, so, like, I think Kant's definition of perpetual peace was, like, I kind of disagreed with it, but, like, in the sense that I think, like, peace is a dynamic process, and I think, like, the implication was, like, if we can do all this, then we'll have peace. You know, and I think that, like, yes, it's true, it'll bring us closer, but, like, I think peace is something that's, since it's dynamic, I think, like, you can never really achieve it. Like, you'll just have to keep, like, kind of, like, I see it as kind of, like, if you want, you want to run to stay in place. So I think, like, because the world is always going to be changing, and then what defines peace, like what the precepts of peace will always be evolving as well. So we just have to evolve to, like, keep up with that. And, like, I don't think there's any one time where, like, if peace is over here and we're over here, that you won't just cross it and be like, oh, I'm at peace. Like, you have to keep on going, and things are going to keep on moving as, like, as the world evolves. And let's see, what else did I write down?
Well, what do you mean by the word evolve? Do you mean that we're, like, do you subscribe to some enlightenment notion of progress? Do you feel like we move forward, we progress forward? Or do you mean evolve just in a more haphazard kind of way that sometimes goes backwards?
Yeah, I think, well, I think it's just change. Like, for one, like the world stage has changed a lot, like, just in the past 500 years, like, with, like, globalization. We've just gotten, like, our definitions of peace have probably changed within, like, the years, and, like, within the past, like, centuries or even decades. And, like, also just, like, with new technologies, like, for instance, with nuclear weapons, it drastically changed what peace meant. Peace meant, like, not destroying each other. And also, like, I mean, this is kind of weird, but, like, if we meet aliens one day, you know, what, like, what will peace mean with them? Like, if we aren't even at peace with ourselves, how can we be at peace with aliens? You know, and also, like, being at peace with the planet, it's not just being at peace with each other, even though, like, that's, I guess that's a good starting point, but, like, you have to be at peace with the planet, which is, I guess, like, the whole green sustainability issue is encompasses that.
And if we go back to your comment about nuclear weapons, I mean, clearly Kant is writing at a moment when nuclear weapons don't exist. At the same time, there are weapons that he is kind of thinking about that do not leave room for apology. What does he have to say about that, or do you remember those particular passages in Kant's text? Were you thinking about those when you were talking?
Yeah, I remember he said that, like, we're naturally inclined to go to war. He outlined these, like, seven steps, like how, like, we have nature's provided us with, like, weapons, and, like, we just, like, we're naturally inclined to, like, go to war. And in a sense, I agree with that, you know, because I think that, like, when you're in a conflict, or, like, when, like, you're afraid of losing your life, that's when you feel most alive. Just, like, having the sense that, like, I could die, and, like, you, and, like, I guess, like, peace is sort of, like, this, like, is sort of born out of, like, the idea that we don't want to be in that state. We don't want to be in the state of danger where, like, we could die, or we could, like, or, like, the people we love could be hurt. And peace is, like, safety and security from that. And, like, I think, like, I thought it was really interesting how he said that peace isn't a natural process, because it goes against, like, this process of war. And, like, I guess if you look in nature, like, nature is a very unforgiving, it's a very unforgiving world, like, with natural selection and stuff like that. So I think that, like, humans, like, as we gradually move ourselves away from nature, I don't know if that's a good or a bad, you know, because, like, in some instances, it's breeded a lot of bad things. Like, we're polluting the planet, we're moving away from what our natural process is, but in a way, it's what defines us. It's like setting ourselves apart from what we should have been, or are we just doing what we always should have been? Like, I don't know.
I mean, I think it's. I entirely agree with you that this issue of nature is for us, of course, a completely different meaning when we think about it than for Kant. Kant was certainly not concerned with environmental issues, and he. I think we also have to bear in mind that we kind of think of nature being, in a sense, under our control, and we've lost that control. Whereas I think for Kant it is the other way around. Nature is the all-guiding principle, and in the end takes care of all our affairs as well, which I think is something we cannot, just simply cannot accept. I mean, in our today's thinking, if we think of the pending natural catastrophes like climate change and this and that. So I think, yes, I agree with you that our concepts have evolved. Also, this idea of the possibility of destruction through weapons has somehow changed the picture. Kant mentions, as Aaron was pointing out, the idea that you should not use in conflicts, in armed conflicts, weapons that would make a peace impossible. Which points also to the interesting question that Kant was apparently counting with a period of time where war was a fact, and so he kind of also envisaged a period of transition until we reach perpetual peace. But you were also skeptical about whether this idea of progress is something we still today believe in, or whether this is something achievable. This idea of history kind of moving towards a better and better or more peaceful world until we reach perpetual peace. Do I understand you correctly that you do not see history as such, but that our definitions change and our concepts change, and one cannot really say whether we are now in a more peaceful world than we were 200 years ago?
I guess just if you ask me, I think we are in a more peaceful world. But I think increasingly, I don't know what the reasons for that, but I think increasingly our world is becoming more complex. Mm-hmm. Like, so I guess if we look at prehistoric times, there were cavemen, and they were, like, running around, and, they were fighting with other tribes, and, like, fighting with nature and trying to survive. And we've definitely come a long way from, like, the cavemen. We've maintained a sense of peace by instituting a lot of like regulations and trying to move away from more like solving our problems by declaring wars and like sort of getting embroiled in a lot of like negotiations and like sort of like political sparring with other nations, and I guess within our own nations as well. And like I think that like. I mean, it's hard to say. Like, I think of course, we have evolved. We've changed the mechanisms, but like ultimately, we still go back to just the age old mechanism of like I declare war on you because we disagree, and I'm going to try to beat you, and then I can make the rules. And
but Kant wouldn't deny that we always had that option. I mean, Kant wouldn't say that is a condition of perpetual peace. He would just argue in introducing certain mechanisms that make it extremely likely, unlikely, or almost impossible for us to conduct war, such as the institution of the rule of law and institution of institutions and that international institutions, commerce, and all these things that he mentions there. So you're saying that in fact it is, war has become less likely for at least certain parts of the world. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I would agree with that. But I think it's because we've come up with substitutions. I think we still have that instinct to like engage in conflict. But because of nuclear weapons, we're just so much more afraid because of technology, because of the advances in technology. There's a big difference between firing a gun and firing a nuclear weapon for us. Mm-hmm. So we've come up with substitutions to actual like aggressive warfare, I don't know if it's even possible, or if we should change the basic instinct of having disagreements with people, because it's so like fundamental to who we are. Mm-hmm. Having the right to disagree with someone is like one of those basic freedoms. Like it's in the First Amendment. Like the right to freedom of speech, the right to disagree with someone. But then the problem is, once you start disagreeing with someone, then like like that's I guess that's where the whole problem starts. But like I don't know if that is even a problem, you know, like
mm-hmm.
I don't know. Like,
but do you think that Kant is arguing for us not to disagree anymore?
No, I don't think I don't think so at all. Like
it is a way of how to deal with that part of human nature.
Yeah,
right?
I think he acknowledges that, like, actually disagreeing with someone is a fundamental right, and that everyone should be able to do that. But I think he says, I mean, in his preliminary article, saying you can't have armies, basically he's limiting our choices of how we can disagree. And I think he sees using words is fundamentally better than using weapons.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's like a very interesting idea, but if we stop using weapons and use only words, and if like somehow we can forget about the notion of weapons, then like won't words just become another like sort of another weapon, like, except like it won't kill you, but like it'll like I don't know, like sticks and stones, but like I don't know, like words will just become the next weapon that we
mm-hmm.
use.
Maybe this is a great question actually for all of us to think about, and I want to keep going around the table because I think it's crucial that we all kind of in a way define our terms to enable a conversation. But how do you think Kant is using language in this text? You know, last night Greg Lambert mentioned how he reads the text, which is as like a peace treaty of sorts. I'm a curator. I also teach in an English department. I was once a poet, so I think very much of language differently, and I think of the way that Kant deploys language here as fundamentally creative. I don't know that it's prescriptive, that like he's laying out these preliminary articles. Clearly, they could be thought of as a peace treaty, but this could also be thought of as a narrative. It could be thought of as an imaginative kind of text that raises more questions than answers. As you were reading this, how are you reading it? I mean, I know that you guys were reading it in part in relationship to courses in philosophy or in political science, but what kind of text was this? Was it a text filled with peculiar characters like assassins and poisoners and statesmen and philosopher kings? Like, how are you trying to make sense of this text as you read through it? Rachel, I'll put you on the spot.
Oh, man. Well, it did, that idea of treaty, like having it sometimes, like people like Kant who write, it's hard to, for me, just the way that I respond to it, it's sort of hard because it does, like the way it's divided up into these pieces makes it read like not like a governmental text, but something that could be less relatable to a larger group of people, unless when you said, like, I can imagine like Kant's being the essay being reworked into some sort of like narrative with all of these weird creatures and so, like a picture book. But I don't know, that I'd like, one thing about his writing I think is that, and if we're talking about pieces involving a larger conversation, that like how many people can relate to his text that aren't in sort of an academic setting or have that greater like connection with reading something that has some lofty words thrown in here and there. Sort of the yeah.
How do you guys read it? You read it differently?
I read it in a political theory class, and a lot of what we talked about there was what political theorists do is visioning something, not something that's necessarily there or that's necessarily provable or ever is going to be, but the idea of a vision. And I felt that was the really strong aspect of the text, because Kant uses a lot of words that are very debatable: human nature, right, good. But I think throughout the text, he has an order that he's trying to direct us towards, a vision of what the world would look like. I mean, he starts pretty much right away with that, with the six articles, you know, abolishing standing armies and such. So that's how I understood the text, is something for us to work towards as a process.
I think for me, and now just to answer Aaron's question, I think it is very interesting that a philosopher writes a text in the form of a treaty. I think this is unusual. I mean, he could have just simply wrote the whole thing as he did, and using it in a sense as a treatise. Writing it as a treaty really points out to the fact that maybe even Kant himself believed that this text was something to be negotiated. I mean, if a peace treaty is not something that somebody writes a text, peace treaties don't have usually authors, you know, single authors. A peace treaty is the result of a negotiation. And that he uses this form at the same time, and I think this is where Aaron maybe is getting, he's being ironic. I mean, it is ironic. There's an irony there that a philosopher writes a text, a philosophical treatise, and he writes it in the form of a peace treaty. There are many elements of irony there, like the secret clauses, that there shouldn't be any secret clauses. Yeah, that is a great pun in a sense. Or the opening clause, yeah, which is the clause supposed to save him, you know, from persecution. The opening clause that since philosophers are not to be taken seriously anyway, they might as well be allowed to speak. Yeah. So there is a lot of irony there, but I think the attempt is serious and points out to what he really wants, and that is not a dogmatic text saying this is what you need to do in order to achieve peace, but I'm proposing this, you know, peace is a negotiated result, and I come up with a first draft. I mean, if you think of how in international relations nowadays multilateral diplomacy works, and it's not so very fun, yeah, to be in a multilateral room of negotiations. It is that somebody puts a proposal on the table, and then the people around the table argue about every line, you know, and change it, and they come with amendments, and then they negotiate together on a final text that everybody can agree on. So for me, the language, the linguistic element of it is that it is very much a text of negotiation. I think he puts that element forward. If you want to respond to that, but also let's keep going with our introduction.
Okay. Well, I guess to address like the previous point, like I agree, he's trying to show that philosophy and statesmanship are not mutually exclusive in this sense. Because I think
they aren't exclusive.
They aren't. Like you can have both at the same time. Like thinking of the first clause when he's discussing how sort of ironically how philosophers are irrelevant, show that how he thinks politics should be can actually be how they are.
Mm-hmm.
Especially think today how people see peace as an abstract that shouldn't be worked towards, but that's something that you can think of in that abstract sense, but in the practicalities of international relations, it's all about security, and it's all about war. So he's saying that you can actually create a discourse of peace that's similar to a discourse of security.
Mm-hmm.
Should I introduce?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm Jackie Labua, I'm from Baltimore, Maryland, and I'm thinking about perpetual peace. I really think it has to be sort of a collective determination that though we're all self-interested and I guess we all want life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for want of a more eloquent phrase, but also everybody else wants that as well, and that war is perhaps, it does not have to be the only viable option to pursue our own ends, because I was thinking about how in Kant when he's talking about how a condition for perpetual peace is republicanism, because it's truly the citizens who know the cost of war and they consider its calamities before they enter in this risky game. But currently I don't really think that everyone realizes or conceptualizes war as calamitous as he would like. I mean, I've grown up Quaker, so the calamitous nature of war has just sort of always been ingrained into me. But as someone who studies political science, or at least that's very much in the minority. And so the question would be, how can you help people realize that cost of war? And I was really struck by what you said, Evangeline, about how you don't like how the AFSC sees peace as an end. And so when Kant's saying that peace is something that should be established, I agree that it's something that needs to be established, but also needs to be consistently reestablished.
because unless we're, you know, in Kant's graveyard or zombies or something, there will always be conflict because we all have interests and our pursuit of interests will sometimes conflict. But realizing that there are alternative strategies to resolving those conflicts other than violence would be a step towards establishing the context where peace can be consistently reestablished.
But do you think we can? I mean, do you think that there is a move towards a more peaceful world, or do you think that this is kind of not a linear progress? That peace needs to be reestablished all the time on the same level, or do you think that we move towards a world that is more and more peaceful in that it establishes the rule of law, establishes the institutions that make it less and less likely to go to war?
To me, it seems to know there are almost opposing forces going against each other. For as much as nation states pursue their interest in terms of security, as much as there are individuals who lack empathy and, you know, pursue their self-interest without regards for others, there are also so many of those who are working for peace. I mean, there, like, the growth of civil society and with globalization and increasing integration and realizing that the sum can be greater than its parts.
Mm-hmm.
In that sense, the world is increasing, but also it feels like the stakes are higher almost because war can be more destructive on a wider scale than ever before. So it seems that as much as there are that there are conditions that create war, there are still many of those who are working for peace. And so the trick is just how can you make, like, are you willing to allocate more resources to waging peace than war?
Mm-hmm.
Martin, are you familiar with the Quaker tradition? I mean, could you explain,
okay,
like, what it means to you to have grown up Quaker?
Yeah, well, Quakers, it's called the Religious Society of Friends officially, and it's one of the historic peace churches, and it's based around the idea that there is that of God in everyone. You can take God as you will. I mean, I personally take it in a very non-Christian sense, but there are plenty of Quakers who do. And so I sort of see it as acknowledging of the basic presence of humanity in all of us, and that there is an intrinsic worth in that humanity that is far greater than anything you can gain by taking it away. And so Quakerism is based around, at least in the tradition that I've followed, it's based around several testimonies, including peace, equality, integrity, and so on. So as a religious tradition, Quakerism has also been really involved in social witness, and is what they call it. And imagine you do Quaker things too. Can you add to that at all?
I think that's a pretty good.
How do Quakers deal with aggression? I mean, armed aggression, violent aggression. That is a calamity. It exists in the world. But how is it explained, and how should one deal with it?
It really depends on the conflict. I mean, particularly in World War II, they're really active in conscientious objector movement, and also how you can serve your country without serving it in a militaristic context. So they were really involved in refugee projects and ambulance and, like, hospital work and stuff like that. So realizing that you can, like, working to make a difference doesn't have to mean working to promote security. And nowadays they also do a lot of work with things like the Alternatives to Violence Project, while, like, letting people know that not just what to do once there's a conflict, but how to keep a conflict from starting in the first place, which is really based a lot on mutual understanding between the involved parties.
Mm-hmm.
So did you find Kant's discussion of cosmopolitanism a relevance there, or did you read something else, or did you identify with Kant's kind of suggestion that standing army should be abolished in time? I mean, were you reading this text from that perspective in a way?
I was reading it sort of as a political scientist and as a pacifist, which was complicated because even though as a pacifist, I feel like everyone should realize, everyone should naturally want hospitality, but also as sort of after reading Hobbes and realizing that, you know, people are self-interested and that you need to, and that pursuit of their interests is often controls actions, And so so reading that as perpetual peace can, there needs to be sort of a transition period, like you were saying earlier, where that perhaps people, not everyone's going to just automatically be like, oh, it's altruistic for me to pursue peace, and therefore I will. But perhaps people need to realize that, oh, it would be more beneficial to me if peace was pursued. So.
For me, this is very interesting because we had in the first workshop a discussion about how this university, which is run a little bit on the idea of the Quakers as well, how this a university and how the students with the code of honor and so on administer, in a sense, yourself, and how the idea of peace works in this context. But have Quakers ever governed a state or have they ever come, you know what I mean? How would a society entirely composed of Quakers look like?
Well, I guess the only historical example was the founding of Pennsylvania, actually,
right.
Where we are, is when William Penn got a charter from the English government he was a nobleman who converted to Quakerism back in the time of its founding, and so he established a Quaker colony where we are now, actually. And its basic tenets involves around not just being a place for Quakers, but also where religious tolerance is practiced openly. And not only that, in terms of establishing a colony, they established really excellent relations with Native Americans based on this concept, not as their inconvenient inhabitants, but there are also people who have that of God inside of them, and therefore it should be treated with respect. So
how about the rights of self-defense? Would they think that people, if attacked, would have a right to bear arms? Or
yeah, that's different for everyone, because there are some Quakers who actually served in World War II and the Civil War, because they really felt that that there was no alternative, there's a lot of talk of what is a just war, and I sort of feel like it's more important to prevent the situations where an in and out of a war has to happen in the first place. And
so this is kind of,
yeah.
There's a debate within the Quaker community,
and
not a dogmatic.
Yeah, so the idea is that most Quakers think is that what you do should, that there's the phrase, like, let your life speak, so you should never let your life speak towards violence, and that anything that you do should not participate to the perpetual nature of war. And there's a story though about George Fox, who was the founder of Quakerism, talking to William Penn, founder of Pennsylvania, and William Penn, he was a nobleman, and he had a sword, and so nobleman thought they always wore swords, and he's like, and so he just said, you know, like, I feel really called to keep wearing my sword because even though I know that it's wrong to commit violence, I feel like it's a part of my identity. And so George Fox looked at him and said, yeah, well, if you feel called to wear a sword, wear it as long as thee can. And so saying that it's not a judgment on people, saying that peace isn't something that should be enforced.
Mm-hmm.
It's that it's an individual journey. And so the role of facilitating people on entering that journey is sort of a purpose I see Quakers serving in the world.
How would William Penn have gotten along with Immanuel Kant? Would he qualify as a Quaker? As a Quaker with these ideas, or would he violate some principles?
I don't know, because Kant is very rational, and so he doesn't come at this from a moral perspective at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Quaker tradition is sort of based around a morality or religious interpretation of humanity. And Kant seems far too rational to, although there's some allusions to morality, it's not explicitly stated that we're doing this because of a higher purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least I didn't get that reading from the text.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, I think they could definitely have an interesting discourse, and they both have a mutual interest in the pursuit of peace. But I think it would be from different perspectives.
I think for Kant, morality is key. I mean, that's one of his big, big questions in his philosophy. Maybe what you are saying is also that the foundations of morality for him are within reason,
right.
whereas
yeah.
for Quakers it their religion. It's a religious motivation, maybe to be a moral person. Would you see that in?
Yeah, definitely. And also, in the writing of this text as a treaty, mm-hmm. he's addressing it in less philosophical terms. So I haven't read more of other Kant.
Interesting enough, because you say the treaty points to that direction. If you think of the Bible, the so-called Old Testament, this was of course also a treaty in a sense between God and his people. So religion can sometimes also take that kind of form and that kind of genre. Okay.
I'm Amy Gruelick. I am from a suburb of Chicago in Illinois. And I actually didn't have to read this for class, and so I haven't read it yet, but I want to after today. But I've always been intrigued by the notion of peace. My mom went to Swarthmore, and after college worked for Friends Committee, and they were working on nuclear proliferation then. So just related to what Quakers believe about, or what they pursue in terms of policies. So to me, perpetual peace, the idea of always striving to, not as an end goal, but as something that to continually remind oneself of or a community of, has real importance. And just the importance of discourse. So that's kind of why I wanted to be here today, because it's something that, as Rachel was talking about, it's often discounted as overly idealistic or too abstract of a notion to be taken seriously, especially in American culture. But I think that treating it as something that has real significance and importance is crucial. And the idea of discourse rather than going to a war of words over war of physical violence is something that I think is important to strive for. And and Jackie was talking a little bit about self-interest and how the Hobbes concept that everyone is self-interested, and that's a valid perspective, but people also share values, and I think that it's very important that not just on an individual level to have peace, but for it to be something that the community accepts as a real thing to strive for. And that I just lost my train of thought.
That's excellent. It's interesting that you again mentioned the war of words, which is something you and you also saw it in a bit of a problematic way, right? That mm-hmm. that words could replace weapons.
Yeah, but also like I see it as also kind of like I don't know. Like have any of you watched the movie A Few Good Men? Like when like Colonel Jessup, he just gets pissed off at Tom Cruise's character. Like he says, like some I forgot it was a really good scene, but like he said something about like there are walls and you can't handle the truth. Like there are walls, and on these walls are people with guns. And like so, I think like if you like in some sense like peace is like I don't know. Like I feel like the world is very chaotic, in a sense. And then like I don't know if this is true or not, but I think the way that Colonel Jessup saw it was like you guys are telling yourself lies. There's no such thing as peace. There's only like, and he's saying like, I provide these walls for you that protect you from the real world, and like, and then you can have your little fantasies about peace. But if those walls are stripped down, then like, all the forces of evil will flood in, and like you'll like see the truth, and you'll be like me basically. And like, I'm not saying I agree or disagree with that, but like it does call into question like. No, I don't think any of us has seen, like, war, apart from, like, pictures or, like, movies and stuff. but it's not the same. And I would be very interested to see like someone who has seen like what peace isn't, or like fundamentally what peace isn't, and like see his or her perspective on what that would be, what that would look like, and how it could be achieved, and if it can be achieved, and stuff like that.
It's interesting that we're talking about like words and peace and seeing peace, because thinking just now, like, it's a lot easier to see war because you can see physically, you can see violence, you can see people with guns, you can see like the terrible effects of war. But when you're talking about seeing peace, like in my head, I have this image of some poster on a wall somewhere with like people hugging each other. There's, you know, but there's like when you talk about seeing peace, what is that? Because is it everyone's really happy and they're, you know, and the people are cohabiting together and are sharing and it's a good, like, how do you, and I think that's what makes it difficult when we talk about peace and people dismissing it, because it's like a harder, it's more of a concept than a physical, like, I can't pull out like my peace gun and, you know, I don't know, it's kind of interesting.
It's also interesting that you say seeing peace and seeing war is not the same thing probably as actually experiencing peace,
mm-hmm.
and experiencing war. I mean, it's not the same thing to see a violent conflict on TV and to actually be there and live through the horrors of the war. I can't say that I have experienced war, but I've experienced traveling through Bosnia Herzegovina after the Dayton Agreement, and I mean, apart from my own feelings, I did have the feeling that these people who had just gone through horrors of genocides, Srebrenica, etc., that they were, in a sense, in a different sphere than myself. It was difficult for me to... I had the feeling to talk to them and understand what they were really going through. And one of the things I felt is that they didn't really want to talk about it. And I've never felt so much the desire for peace as among the people of the former Balkans, by simply not wanting to talk about... I was shocked and curious and asked them questions, you know, and they said, let's not talk about it, it's awful, we're happy it's over. So in that sense, peace as the traumatic experience of what war really meant had this dimension for me.
Have any of you experienced or seen the aftermath of conflicts? Or would you agree with what your colleague had said, that you haven't seen it in any sense?
I was in Cambodia a few years ago, and the same thing, they didn't want to talk about it at all. Which kind of ties into the idea of words as violence, like for them to
mm-hmm.
discuss it is reliving it, and that's something they don't want to do at all. So while we were going there to learn about the genocide, most people didn't, unless they were catering to us as visitors, they really didn't want to discuss it. On my homestay, both the parents were in their 50s, so they obviously lived through it, because it was 30 years ago. But it just wasn't something they tried to think about if they could avoid it.
I don't know if we've ever experienced peace in the sense that sort of the concept of we're always in a period of truce or suspension of hostility or in war. So I don't know if there's ever been a time where the specter of war hasn't always been there.
Mm-hmm.
It might have been, like right now, I mean, I've never been in a violent conflict. Or, I mean, I've, you know, I live in Baltimore, like, I hear about it all the time, but I've never, like, personally experienced it, but I always know it's there. And so is peace when you forget that war is a possibility in that sense, or is it...
I think, I mean, I don't know, I come up with a ridiculous proposal, but when you want to experience peace, go to Switzerland. I mean, this is, I don't know, when, yes, it gets pathetic to imagine Switzerland attacking Austria or something, you know. I mean, this is, although if you go back 1,000 years, Switzerland was attacking Austria. I mean, Switzerland was gaining its independence by getting rid of the Habsburgs. And Europe, I mean, there were all sorts of wars. I would probably, by just naming them, we would spend 3 days in a row. And now, could we imagine, I mean, the European Union, at least the European Union, maybe it is within this wall that you described, yeah? But could you imagine that the countries of the European Union, that France would at any time soon attack Germany or Switzerland, Italy or Belgium, the Netherlands? I mean, I think there are arrangements today between countries that not so long ago were involved in tremendous warfare, that they really have managed to achieve a state of peace with all its problems, yeah, and we can discuss about them. But I think Kant makes some concrete proposals in his text, the institutional proposals. And when we had our project, and we had some ambassadors and diplomats from Europe, they felt inspired by this text and felt that Europe somehow has managed, at least within the borders of the European Union, not within the continent, unfortunately, but within the borders of the current members of the European Union, war seems really very, very unlikely. And when one thinks about it, one always almost laughs. Doesn't mean that I'm wrong, doesn't mean that events might unfold in the next years, decades, that change the picture. But Switzerland and Austria, I don't think, will be war-leading nations very soon.
How do you guys account for the rise of the far-right parties in Europe or elsewhere?
Well, I just wanted to respond to something before. But I kind of think it's problematic for us to think as war as something that's just between large groups of people and that maybe we can never imagine ourselves in something like that. It's like not going to happen to us. Because, I mean, I feel like that's the highest, like that large conflict is the highest level of war, maybe one of them. But it has to start somewhere. Like there's little bubblings of war and it starts between, I mean, I don't want to always stress the individual, but I mean, it starts with small groups of people and then the individual. And I think that to say that we have never experienced war is kind of not good, because maybe what we haven't experienced the highest level of war. Maybe we experience smaller forms of war that we just don't necessarily consider to be part of the definition of war.
Could I, maybe this will be a too concrete kind of response to that, but you know, I live in Philadelphia, and so last night I came out in Philadelphia, and I kind of think of Haverford in a way as Philadelphia, but in a certain sense it isn't. You know, we passed by this morning a Ferrari dealership, and the part of Philadelphia I'm in, we're 5 blocks from a very, very different socioeconomic scenario. Do you think of kind of I mean, so as you try to rethink what war would mean, right, how we would perhaps see conflict as something that is endemic to our lives and not just to be understood as armed conflict, would you think of, like, Philadelphia, for instance, as a city or as a space in which one could read that violence, one could see that violence? Do you think of it in terms of socioeconomic disparity? Do you think of it, you know, how to... do you think of everyday life here in the States as one that's violent, even if you yourself aren't impacted by it in a kind of a physical way? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I don't, and violent not as in like always with guns and weapons, but yeah, I do.
And you guys, yeah, what's your relationship, I guess, to Philadelphia in a certain sense?
Well, I guess I wanted to respond to something previously, so I'll wait until...
No, please.
Well, I guess you just said previously, your question was, what do you think accounts for the rise of far-right politics? And I think that's an interesting question, because it seems like it's not even necessarily far-right politics that, like, I think of is problematic for peace. You know, when if you turn on the news, everything is like this... intense like fight between two diametrically opposed groups, like Democrats and Republicans will never get along. India and Pakistan never going to reach an agreement. Israel Palestine never going to happen. Like all of this, angry tension, blah 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 blah, all that stuff. And I think it's indicative of the fact that we've all kind of, as a society, we've succumbed to the notion, the basic realist notion that, we're all self-interested and we can never overcome self-interest. And I think I think even Kant, in a way, is boxed into that. He follows after Hobbes and he thinks that human nature is competitive and self-interested, and the only reason that we're naturally bound to peace is because we end up meeting each other for commerce, and then we bind each other in that way, and so we're forced to get along. But I don't think that's fair. I don't think it's fair to agree that life has to be nasty, brutish, and short. It's only nasty, brutish, and short if you make it that way. And, life can also be enriching and fulfilling and meaningful in other ways than that. And so I guess when I think of perpetual peace, it seems something that's outside of that box, where collective the will of the collective, where you are not the one that matters, like the group is the one that matters, where self-interest is not as important as we think it is today. And I think that this notion of self-interest is both what denies us even the conditions of possibility for perpetual peace, or even the conditions of possibility for thinking about perpetual peace, and it's what fuels what we see with far right and far left politics.
And do you think of Haverford as a space in which one thinks differently about this? I mean, it's interesting that all of you have brought up the issue of self-interest. It's interesting to me not just because it's something that emanates from the text itself, Kant's essay of perpetual peace, that question, but it's also interesting because it's not necessarily a question that others in the past workshops have meditated so specifically on. So I guess I was interested, do you think this question of self-interest has something to do with the questions one thinks about here in the Haverford community?
Well, that's sort of what I was getting into, that that we aren't solely motivated by self-interest because we take unproctored exams. Like, if we were solely self-interested, we would all cheat on them. And the assumption is that we do not, which is...
So what does that mean, an unproctored exam?
So we don't have... We're not in, like, a large
Nobody's
group.
Nobody's watching.
Yeah, right? No one's watching. You're trusted to abide by the rules of it and take it within the allotted time frame. And
turn yourself into honor council if you do something wrong, or you're supposed to watch out for peers, so it's not like, it's not like there's Big Brother watching you and gonna crack the whip when you do something wrong. You're expected to monitor your own behavior and do the right thing.
But can I just defend Kant and self-interest here a little bit in this context of not cheating at an exam? I mean, might it not be also a higher form of self-interest in not to cheat in an exam, because you kind of have the feeling if we all don't cheat at the exam, it'll serve us all better, and then it will serve me again better, because I'm then in a community that where exam results are meaningful. So it could be, it's almost like game theory, it serves my self-interest as long as everybody else obeys that rule. And then we are again a little bit in what Kant kind of thinks. I mean, humans, even though they are principally governed by self-interest, might come to agreements, among themselves, where they give up their most selfish, brutish interests for the community and the state. And then the states give those self-interests up and form a federation.
That's what Rousseau is, isn't it? It's social contract. The collective interest is self-interest.
Yes.
I think that's interesting, because maybe at the state level that's how it would have to work, because self-interest is necessary for the survival of the state. It's geared towards security. That's mm-hmm. what a state is. But I don't think many people here think that the reason that they don't cheat on exams is to make sure that other people don't cheat. It's an honor code because it's honorable. Mm-hmm. And the honorable reason to not cheat is because it's the wrong thing to do, period. Mm-hmm. Like, it kind of defeats the intrinsic value of having self-governance. So, mm-hmm. I mean, if everybody in the community thought, well, the only reason that we should, follow these rules is because that's the only reason, the only way that they'll work, I think there would be something missing. And I don't think that's how it works.
It's a moral question. It's not just...
Which, by the way, Kant, when in his moral philosophy, would entirely agree with you. You should not do something because it's in your self-interest. You should do it because it's the right thing to do.
But I think in political theory, he takes the human self-interest for granted.
I think that's kind of exactly what he's saying, isn't it, when he talks about not using, like, assassins and poisoners and stuff. In sort of like a, there needs to be a certain level of trust between the world community, just like there needs to be a certain level of trust within the Haverford community,
mm-hmm.
that you sort of, there are certain things that you could do and that could advantage you in the short term, but in the long term doesn't allow for that level of trust between everybody
mm-hmm.
that kind of advances everybody.
Mm-hmm. I think that that's, I agree with that entirely. Maybe we can continue with you and your definition because I don't have that much time anymore, but I think a trust is something that we've now worked out as a very necessary condition for a society to strive and on international level as well. Yeah. Maybe you introduce yourself.
Sure. I'm Emma Mongovan. I'm from St. Paul, Minnesota. I guess I would say that my definition of perpetual peace would be a situation in which using violence as a recourse when there's a conflict would just not really be an option. And I think that that's something that would be very difficult to get to. But I think that as long as you sort of feel like violent action is a legitimate option, I think that you can't really have peace. And I feel like there's a certain respect for human life that's necessary in the idea of a perpetual peace, and that having any sort of possibility of violence kind of undermines that.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I mean, I guess my definition would basically be a situation in which it's kind of mutually agreed that violence is just not an option that anyone can use.
Mm-hmm. How about you?
My name is Kristen Tan, and I'm from Naperville, Illinois. And when I think of perpetual peace, I think of mutual respect between people on an individual level, and then also on like a larger scale, like respect for, you know, different nations' sovereignty, in whatever capacity people want to define it. And I think that the respect component is so important because once you have respect, and also I'm going to add like an agreement on some type of set of human rights or some set of things that everyone agrees that that everyone has like some quality about them and certain rights, then that's a point when people can start to trust each other, and you know, trust that underhanded things like poisoners or assassins or those types of things won't be used, and from there you could, you know, maybe have some reason to justify, like, not having standing armies or not having, I don't know, like, not needing to, like, reserve causes for future wars. But I think that it's something, like, I think about after, in Kant's essay when he's talking about nation should never do something where do something like unforgivable or something that's going to leave like resentment left over for future conflicts, that if we're at a point when that could ever happen, you know, because we have so much history with like underhanded things that like say the United States has done in South America in, you know, helping coups or whatever, like how do you regain that trust of people when there's such lasting effects of the violence and what's gone on. But I mean, you brought up like I didn't really think about this before, like now thinking about like France and Germany like going to war with each other, I wouldn't be like that would never happen, even though not so long ago there was this huge conflict between them,
two of them.
Yeah. So I mean, obviously like something happened and they got over it, you know, to use that loosely.
It's interesting. I think you bring up a very interesting aspect, this idea of memory, of collective memory, can be a source of war. And I think you're very right. I mean, if you think of the role of history and historical memories in the Balkans, for example, how the Serbs were thinking of some battle of the Kosovo in the 13th century and you know, and draw their their resentments from that, and then there were other memories. Kant doesn't say much about this, but there's another philosopher, Nietzsche, who really says that sometimes it's actually quite good for individuals to get on with their lives, and also for countries to simply forget. And I think sometimes it's necessary to forget past conflicts and past resentments in order to get on. I think it's a very important contribution to world peace if people can forget at a certain point, or forgive would be probably an even nicer word. But I think we have very little time left, and the two of you haven't had a chance yet.
Sure. I try to view perpetual peace in a more narrow-minded view, maybe, and I think more in light of what Kant was talking about. And when I thought of perpetual peace, I thought of a sustainable absence of conflict between states or actors. I was thinking more on the international level. And all I wanted to briefly mention, there's a point made earlier about stability, and I think in the past we've seen this false choice between for self-determination and stability, in particular more powerful actors such as the United States. And I think part of the problem with stability is that without internal peace, that it's not necessarily sustainable. And what I link this to in my paragraph and what I'd been thinking about was in order to have internal peace, there needs to be some sort of satisfaction with the status quo. And I think Kant realized this when Kant laid out certain rules for that kind of had to be followed, you know, republican government, not having certain nations in debt to other nations. And I think part of the problem is, as long as Kant realized that there have to be certain restrictions or certain guidelines that have to be bought into before you can create a sustainable absence of conflict. And as long as there are a number of gross inequalities, or as long as people see a have or a have not, Kant spoke briefly about invading other territories out of want, or seeing it as profitable. As long as there are these gross inequalities and people aren't satisfied with the present status quo, it's impossible to have internal peace. And without internal peace, there can be no stability. And without stability, it's very difficult to have a sustainable absence of armed conflict. Mm-hmm. So,
I think this is absolutely fascinating, your analysis. And you're basically pointing out to Kant, stressing the fact of the internal factors, which I think some of you put, and also on the individual, which I think is also a very interesting idea as a necessary condition. But I think it's very important what you've pointed out, that he really looks at the state itself, which is an interesting idea, not very often done. When you look at the international system, sometimes people disregard whether it's necessary to have a democracy or a dictatorship or whatever in order to provide stability. You need internal stability and sustainable internal stability, which I think is a very important point. You didn't get a chance to give your definition yet, so please go ahead.
I've said most of what I'd want to say, but I'm Matthew. I guess the one other thing I'd want to add is I think it's interesting that, it seems like when you first read Perpetual Peace, you think, oh, well, like, how utopian is this? This is this really abstract, like, what is peace? How nice would that be? But then if you read his solution, which is eventually, you know, all the states will still have self-interest, will still be, you know, competitive, but will be forced to get along with each other because we need each other. You know, it seems like in a way that's not good enough. I want to go big or go home. So, you know, if you want perpetual peace, you want a group or a unity, like, you know, maybe a global governance that really works or something along those lines, where the people, you know, it's actually not that they're competing with everybody else and just having to find a happy medium. It's that X state, like, has a genuine interest in people of another state, and there's the collective matters more than any individual, not just because it sustains you, but because they have intrinsic value. So I don't know. I think that the way to get around the way to get there is to not just not a, not succumb to the notion that states will always be competitive, and that, you know, to put some faith in a system of governance where people are willing to agree and to cooperate in like a genuine cooperation for the benefit of everyone. And if we don't think like that, I don't think we're ever going to get there. But I don't see any reason why that couldn't happen if more people started to believe that that was a genuine possibility.
And so you think Kant is a bit too pessimistic?
Yeah, I mean, almost. It's kind of funny because, I mean, obviously he's not pessimistic. But yeah, I mean, I think in a way, I think he could go farther. He's already 90% of the way there. Might as well say go 100%.
Mm. Well, I think has been a fascinating second workshop for us, which went in a completely different direction than the first one. And I think there was a common theme there, which was this idea of, in a sense, a criticism that all of you shared of Kant, most of you shared of Kant, not going the 100%, only being there 90%, kind of criticizing about Kant's view on human nature. We started out that this was a kind of most important thing to look at human nature. And that somehow I have the feeling that you would all argue necessary factor and guarantee for perpetual peace and improvement of mankind somehow, that we need to not give up that idea, which is a very moral idea of improving, of self-improvement and of improving our communities. And Kant, I think, has a more mechanistic, more, I would say, I wouldn't say immoral, because morality plays an important part for him, but a more, as you said, I think, a more rationalistic approach to it, where he tries to take human nature as he sees it in a pessimistic way, and see how this would work out via providence and via nature, and how it would anyway have, in a sense, a happy end. And you think this is not sufficient, and you think that, in a sense, Kant is in that sense not able to answer or address many of the current conflicts and problems, as you were mentioning before, of the environment and that. And I think this for me was an interesting angle, and I learned a lot from you. Thank you very much.